Cracked Spines, where every book is a survival manual if you read it right. Or, in the case of the book we did today, sometimes you don't survive at all. So sometimes that's also fun.
Is a survival manual not sometimes a list of things you shouldn't do, though?
Yeah, that's how our nursing textbooks work. There's a lot of case studies which are like, and that's why we count sponges.
Oh, God. Sorry, I just like feel like I suddenly flash through every possible scenario in nursing which could lead to that.
Yeah, let me tell you, in terms of books that'll just leave you on the edge of your seat, just a collection of nursing case studies is the pretty much the most stressful reading you can have. Just the whole, like, clenching to be like, did the patient die? No, thank God. He just lived with horrifying pain for the next 10 years.
Oh, God.
Thank God. Luckily, the problem was extremely preventable. Much like this situation. Was that an okay transition? Donner party could have gone better?
It was a decent transition, I'd say. Don't want to put too much blame on the parties involved, but there were certainly mistakes were made. I think we can conclusively say that.
Mistakes were made. Passive voice. We can spread that around to a lot of different people, you know.
Hey, did we say who we are?
Who am I, Amelia?
You are a beautiful, charming, super smart nursing student who's learning how to save lives and is here to dish out the very best in weird medical facts related to this book.
Oh, thank you.
And you're a fucking idiot also, but I love you anyways.
Well, okay, well, I was gonna say happy birthday to you, because it's your birthday.
It's not my birthday yet. You
know. It's not your birthday yet, but it will be when we post this fucking episode, because it won't actually be a day past your birthday. Amelia, I'm just trying to support you here. You give me nothing. You're just sitting in a van. You're back in the van.
I am!
You're out there in the wilderness. You're getting rained on, or something.
Actually,
you're,
it's
like, experiencing
pleasant.
Nature.
It's really nice.
Well, it's very rainy and cold here.
So, this week, we read the book we said we were gonna read. That's right, guys, we did actually read it. We read The Indifferent-
I'm better, by the way. I feel better. Amelia's not in Hawaii anymore, which sucks for her, but I personally no longer feel sick, which is just nice.
Yeah, that'll last about a week.
Honestly, though, we started this before this episode, I was like, Amelia, I feel a little sick. So I think we've actually gone long enough that I'm now ill with a new thing.
Yeah, you'll be feeling sick again by the time the episode is over.
Anyway, our book is The Indifferent Stars Above, The Harrowing Saga of a Donner Party Bride by James Daniel Brown. Nope, by Daniel James Brown. He has too many names.
Too many
Can't
first
blame
names.
A girl. Can't. Too many first names. You get one, Daniel.
Brown.
We're gonna get the title wrong so many times while discussing this.
Oh, yeah. So, as you guys might have noticed, we're kind of working a theme of, like, ill-fated mountain expeditions right now. Our most immediately previous episode was one on a book called Dead Mountain, which was about the... What is the name of the thing, again, in Russian, Sarah?
The Dyatlov Pass incident?
Yes. And then, the week before that, we did The Hunger by Almakatsi, which was a fictionalization of the Donner Party incident. So, this is our first nonfiction book that we're reading on that topic, so I'm pretty excited to kind of get into the actual facts of what happens. And I think the comparison of this book, the nonfiction version, to the fictionalized supernatural account is super interesting. And I actually felt
yes.
like beneath the fucking God, The Indifferent Stars Above, I felt like that book was actually a bit more narratively gripping than the fiction one, ironically.
I agree, and I think, weirdly enough, the fiction one added elements of horror and made it less horrifying, while The Indifferent Stars Above, like, makes you sit in the knowledge of, like, drawing lots to see who you're going to eat, or having to divide up the bodies so no one has to eat their relatives.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know?
The specificity was really what got me in this one. And we're gonna go into more detail, like, later on after we've discussed The Indifferent Stars Above in greater depth, but for now, I just feel like I was really interested by all the things that The Hunger actually didn't even touch on, because there were just a lot of things that literally happened that I was like, that would have been so good, and I really don't know why the author didn't include them.
And I think it's really interesting just in terms of, like, the author chose to end The Hunger at what in The Indifferent Stars Above is nowhere near the ending
point.
And
in fact, in The Indifferent Stars Above is in many ways just the beginning of the very worst stuff.
Yeah. Although, also, there's a line where he's like, little did they know the nightmare was about to begin. And I was like, people have already been eaten.
Daniel!
there's already dead people, Daniel! Daniel! What do you mean the nightmare's already begun? You can say the nightmare's gonna get worse. But I think the nightmare kicked off somewhere in the salt desert.
Yeah, for sure. So, I think it does kind of raise some interesting points about the way that this book was written, because it is nonfiction, and there is a lot of non-fictional details in there. And one thing that I really loved about it was the fact that it had this literal narrative where the author chose to follow the kind of quote-unquote plot line, for lack of a better word, of Sarah Graves. Mm-hmm. Whereas in The Hunger, one of the main viewpoint characters was Mary Graves, who is Sarah's younger sister. So that was another interesting choice. I definitely felt like the choice of Mary instead of Sarah was to kind of allow for that romance between Mary Graves and Charles Stanton, which would obviously mm-hmm. have been less, you know, feasible between Sarah, who is a newlywed in reality, and, well, I don't even know what she is in The Hunger, because I remember literally nothing about her in that book. She had kind of no presence in my memory.
Yeah, I don't really recall her featuring, which is a shame because, well, I mean, different viewpoint characters. You bring sort of different stuff to the story, and especially with this nonfiction one, where he's up front that plenty of times he has to extrapolate what she was probably feeling yeah. or what they might have been doing based off what he understands of her situation, what it would have been like to be a bride in this time, like the like the general historical details you have to try and color in the scant information of one specific woman. But the way he colored in Sarah Graves, I thought, was really emotionally affecting, especially her hopes, the hopes you can see that she had for both her family and her brand new love match wedding. It made me sad for yeah. the way those hopes were very not
pretty thoroughly
supported.
Crushed.
Yeah.
In fact, like, probably worse than anyone could ever imagine.
You know how sometimes a skill for anxiety is to think of the best case scenario, think of the worst case scenario, and then think of a middle of the road scenario. And so in this way, you've sort of explored the three different possibilities, while acknowledging that two of them are highly unrealistic, and the third one, the middle of the road one, is the one you're most likely going to get. Do you think Sarah Graves lying in her bed is like, she's like, best case scenario, we get there and we're just like, we get like all of California. It's great. Worst case scenario, I mean, I guess we die, you know. Middle of the road, we have a pretty uncomfortable trip, we get there and we start a new life, it'll be difficult, but it'll be ultimately worth it. And then you think, like, 6 months later, she was like, didn't dig deep enough. Didn't dig deep enough for the worst case scenario, should have gone deeper.
Should have thought about eating my family members.
Should have thought about the death of, a lot of people I love.
Yeah. So, you know me, and the fact that my interest in cannibalism is largely narrative and thematical and sexual, but...
Huh?
What? Nothing. I thought we could maybe try and be a bit more sensitive, I guess, in our discussion of it.
Because we're out of puns.
Yeah, that's it. We're literally out of puns, guys. I'm so sorry. I thought it would be easier to stomach if, you know, we phrased it.
Okay. That's not even a good one. We're out, Amelia. We're out.
Listen, you can't blame me for reaching, okay? I hunger for those cannibalism puns.
Do you want to finish your spiel about the sensitivity?
Oh, no, no. No, that's done. If we come up with any more puns, we're going to make them, right? I mean...
Yeah, but in, God, the most sensitive way possible.
Oh, yeah.
Because I will say, reading this book was horrifying in a way that is like, oh god. Well, okay, I was gonna say delicious and horrifying, but then I was like, I can't, because the pun. But I don't even mean it like that. I would use it if it was a different thing and be like, ooh, this book is deliciously horrifying. But then it's a more weighted term in this particular context, so I'm not going to use the phrase.
You didn't need to explain straight-faced why you can't use the phrase deliciously horrifying when talking about real-life cannibalism. I think people get it.
Yeah, I just can't think of another adjective, Amelia.
How about thrillingly horrifying?
Tantalizingly.
No.
No. Well, this was horrifying in the way that sometimes you watch a YouTube video and you're like, this is the fucking grossest, you say, as you already send it to three friends. There was something about when I was reading this, there was something about the visceral nature of what, like, it was written with, and the I don't want to keep using the word horrifying. I don't want to, like, beat it into the ground, but that's really the adjective that keeps coming to mind. But the way that the details were so specific and so understandable, it's a horror and a tragedy of, like, perfectly understandable escalation, that there was just something about it that made me, like, corner multiple relatives during different times and just tell them about events I just read, and none of them enjoyed it. None of them appreciated the stories I was telling, but I just had to tell them what I was reading.
Yeah, it was really gripping. I just really felt like I found it a lot more genuinely engaging even than the fiction. And I agree, and I think that one of the things about the horror was the fact that it just didn't end. Things just keep getting worse from the very beginning that they leave, especially on the Hastings cutoff. It's just like suffering, 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 and just different kinds of suffering. And you're suffering because it's hot and you don't have any water, and you're suffering because you're losing all the money that you invested on this trip, and you're suffering because it's hot and there's no water again. And then, you know, the road is really rough, and then you're suffering because you're snowed in, and then you're suffering because you're hungry, and you're hungry, and you're hungry, and then you're trying to snowshoe across this pass. We're kind of getting ahead of things here, but you get the gist.
And you're either part of the team that's snowshoeing across the pass, or you're part of the team that's not, in which case you are waiting for rescue that you have no assurance of.
So I guess in that vein, do we want to maybe jump into talking about the actual kind of plot and sort of what...
Plot's an interesting way to discuss it, because, I mean, it is, again, it's a historical narrative of basically... I mean, it's a history of 87 pioneers going west as part of the manifest destiny. The whole idea of, like, life was just going to be easier and freer further west.
Yeah, I liked all the details that the author...
Nope.
Sorry.
No, I mean, not nope to you. I mean, nope to the concept of
hope. Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, for some people, maybe, but yeah, you really gotta get lucky in that. I liked the details the author gave about the life that the Graves family lived before they left. And the author does focus specifically on the Graves family, and specifically on Sarah Graves. And I really liked the fact that he focused on a woman, you know? I thought that it was really interesting, because it would have been easy to focus on one of the men. Even her father, Franklin Graves, who is a very heroic figure in a lot of ways, it would have been easy to make him the figure that they focus on and be like, wasn't he so noble? But I think that choosing Sarah as our kind of entry point into the story, it allowed a different point of view, and the point of view of somebody who wasn't that sort of stereotypical action hero protagonist, but that gave a much more almost like sensitive and disturbing rendition of this real story as a result.
Yeah, because, I mean, spoilers for history, but Sarah Graves makes it all the way through. She's one of the ones who makes it all the way to California. And so the ability to follow her as a character is you follow someone from setting out across the journey and then to the continued difficulties of California, where it's not in as much detail as the rest of the section, but basically talking about she is the one who is responsible for pulling together what is left of her family and supporting it. And you can't just imagine this going through this horrific ordeal and then being left on the other side penniless and destitute, you know, and reliant on the kindness of others. And I got so sad reading about her in the epilogue because I just wanted her to be happy, but I don't know if in the facts of her life that we have, we can say either way whether or not she was, I can say, you know what, I can say she had almost certainly untreated PTSD.
Yeah, I'd say most of the people from the Donner Party that survived probably did.
Yeah, most of, huh? Who's the fucking happy-go-lucky, like, person you're picturing who's just like, I mean, I ate a couple of my cousins, didn't I? And it all worked out fine.
Didn't know them that well, so...
It's just me, a classical pioneer. Western, going west on me old oxen.
Well, hey, actually, you know, James, the Reed family, I believe, were Irish emigrants, I think, so...
Do you think this is an Irish oxen? Oi, it's my Tom Hardy. Go watch me movie Venom.
I don't know what Tom Hardy's regular voice sounds like. I just know him as Mad Max, like...
water. The desert is death. I will eat my fellow man to survive.
Yeah, so this is kind of a Mad Max, but the snowy version, really. No, it's not. I don't know why I said that.
This could not be less like Mad Max.
Hey, I mean, there's, like, really intense wagoneering going on, so...
Yeah, I think my favorite part of the Donner Party is the doof warrior hanging out on the back of a covered wagon playing a fucking mandolin.
Yeah, they had fiddles and stuff. That was a thing.
We found him in a cave and just sort of stuck him on up there.
Yeah, that's like a crazy part of the Mad Max mythology that is actually canon. So anyways, to kind of get back into the historical events. So this is taking place, to sort of place it in history, the party itself leaves in 1846, right? Let me just check.
Yes, 1846. The presidency of Polk.
Yes, Sarah Graves left Illinois in 1846, which her home was like this mosquito-infested thing where they literally, oh god, it sounded so awful. They talk about how the mosquitoes were so bad that sometimes they had to, like, fill the entire house with smoke, open the doors to, like, let all the mosquitoes out, and then, like, army crawl in underneath the smoke, and then just, like, sit in their smoky house and be like, at least we're not being eaten alive anymore.
Oh, boy.
So...
Which I also love, I mean, you know, it's that's a terrible way to live, but I do... There's this, like, section where they're just like, we don't know, why didn't the Native Americans settle down here in this good farmland? You know, it's so flat and close to water.
And then, so like,
presumably swampy. Presumably the native tribes are like,
yeah, fuck that.
Okay, yeah, have fun with that one.
Yeah. So yeah, there were factors driving them away, and those factors do largely seem to be the hooking mosquitoes. Which again, that is fair. I would risk life and limb to escape living in those circumstances.
I remember at one point when we were being particularly tormented by mosquitoes, and I asked you, if you had a button to kill all the mosquitoes in the world, would you? And keep in mind, and I was, like, gonna say some other stuff about the ecosystem, and, like, I was gonna try and, like, be like, now, really think about the implications, and you're like, smash, 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 smash that button. Kill them all.
No,
you can't tell me shit about their value.
It literally wasn't even just a hypothetical. We were talking about a podcast episode we listened to about mosquitoes, where I'm pretty sure they asked, like, mosquito scientists about, like, hey, if there was a button you could press and it killed all the mosquitoes in the world, would that be bad? And I distinctly remember the mosquito scientists, entomologists, I don't know what the fuck the bug doctor is called.
Bug boy.
The bug doctors were like, it probably would be bad. We can't exactly say how.
One bug doctor, I think, was like, kill them all. And others were like, we don't really know what'll happen if you remove an entire part of an ecosystem.
Profit.
I did read an essay that was just literally entitled something like, you shouldn't kill all the mosquitoes in the world because they're living creatures, and you shouldn't destroy an entire species because you don't like them.
Sounds like a fucking cloud of mosquitoes in a trench coat wrote that.
They killed the guy in the trench coat, though. So, I mean,
yeah, they're kind of heroes. Sucked all his blood and then crawl inside. So anyways.
So their home sucked.
Yeah, they were heading west in the hopes of finding that mythical mosquito-killing button. And they were doing so in 1846, which is the year that the Mexican-American War began. Like you said, President Polk had been, like, warmongering for a really long time because he wanted to use war with Mexico as an excuse to essentially seize California. So that was something that was going on in the sense that literally all the people who were heading to California in that time were essentially illegal immigrants. The irony. So, that was kind of a thing where some people were like, I don't know if I want to go to California if this is going to be like a war zone. But other people were like, I want to go to California and like enlist and like, you know, earn myself a lot of new territory and money and regard because obviously war is profit. So that was definitely the kind of background information stuff that was going on during this time period.
Yeah. There, I mean, there's such a sense of, American moving forward. This is a theory that won't come out until about 1900, but the theory of the frontier is what makes America America. The idea that you can always push further west, you can always push into new land if you want freedom. It was this thought that like what differentiated America from the European nations that so many of its settlers had come from was that there wasn't a landed gentry who could control everything, you know, because there was quote unquote free land as far west as the ocean, and it was Americans' right to claim it. And that the frontier was like this really important part, the idea of the pressure valve of democracy and liberty, that if everything's got tense in the east, you can just keep going west. Much like you have lived your life.
Yeah. And that was what drove the Graves family on their ill-fated journey west.
Mm-hmm. They're part of this much larger movement.
Yeah. Back then, many people would, essentially, these wagon trains would form up because there's safety in numbers, and you needed to have other people around that you could rely on, you know, to both make your wagon train, like, more defensible, even though, like, skirmishes with Native Americans did not actually have a very large effect on a grander scale. It was, like, very much in the public consciousness that was, like, something that a lot of people were afraid of. So that was something that they definitely tried to avoid, even though obviously they had other concerns, which they would soon find out.
Yeah, it is this thing of like it wasn't a non-issue, you know. Even the Donner Party, I believe, has some of their cattle, some of their livestock stolen from a Native American tribe as they're passing. And there are definitely examples of violence between settlers and Native Americans as westward expansion happened. It wasn't nearly as prevalent as popular imagination made it.
Yeah.
But you could also, it's racism is a big factor. You can also see like the terror people might have of like.
I'm sorry, did you say the terror? Did you say that?
Never mind.
We're talking about that now? Hey, I can talk about racism and the terror if you want.
Oh, yeah, also against Native populations. Boy, you know,
the 1860s were not a great time for fucking white people being kind and understanding towards people other than themselves. You know what, though? Has there ever really been a time when that has been the case?
Anyway. Real talk. Do you remember the one paragraph in this book that was mentioning how the Franklin Party was happening at the same time as this?
Oh yeah, I remember that because I nutted.
No, you're losing protein. Possibly?
I don't think so.
I just sort of assumed it would have protein in it.
I don't know.
When you nut, does it protein? Is it protein shake? Yeah. Yeah, so they were taking the they're taking this new path, the Hastings Cutoff, which had never been tried by the actual guy who named it.
Yeah, and apparently he literally just looked at a map and, like, presumably did, like, a series of shots before that and was like, why don't we just go this way? I'm gonna write a book about it and tell people to do that.
He probably did the thing that I do when I look at Google Maps, and Google Maps is like, yeah, it's like 14 miles away. I'm like, dope, 14 miles away, no problem. And then,
14 miles? 14 minutes, got it.
Got it. And then I'll be like, time to drive there, and they'll be like, okay, this route is 20 miles, and I'll be like, why? You lying to me. Why are you lying?
Yeah, I know. I also actually, like, experience that. I feel like Google needs to give you the estimate of, like, how long the shortest actual path is, because, like,
yeah.
What Not use the, is it
I can't me? Drive through
I don't have a town. Fucking hovercraft, Google.
I'm not a crow, and I cannot use this measurement that you've given me. Point is, Hastings is valid, and he was doing his best, and it just cost many lives.
I don't think he was doing his best. I will say that.
Yeah, well, it was 125 miles longer than the established route, and did require them to blaze an entirely fresh trail through a mountain range, and then do an 80-mile hike across arid lowlands that eventually became the Utah Great Salt Desert.
Why do you say eventually became? Like, eventually was named that, or?
No, it transitioned into it. It's like, you start, and you're like, oh, this is arid lowland. And then you're like, lot of salt. And then you're like, this is pretty great. And then you're like, oh no, this is the desert. You know?
Yeah. And I mean, like, you hear
And then you're
words...
like, oh no, this is Utah!
Yeah.
I was gonna say, and then because they left so late in the year, and because it was a new route, and because they had such difficulty along it, I think for a variety of reasons, they reach the lake. They reach the lake where they camp, and then they're like, okay, we'll press on. And then they wake up, and there's 5 feet of snow, and they're like, guess we'll die. And that's really when the Donner Party is. We know it.
Yeah.
Kicks off. Yeah. That's when the nightmare begins. Daniel.
Just in case the having to literally, like, lift and carry your wagons up a mountain and trekking across a salt desert in which all of your livestock dies, in case that wasn't a nightmare, you know.
Also, like, at least three people have died at this point. One of whom was an old man that Louis Kesseberg was like, I'm not gonna let you hitch the widen the wagon anymore.
Yeah, which,
I said wide. Should we redo that so I don't say that?
Would you like to redo that?
We are talking about the murder of an old man, so maybe I should pronounce some words correctly. I guess not the murder, I guess just the knowing decisions to force him to do something that would undeniably result in his death, but I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer either, but that seems like a shitty thing to do. And that was one thing where it was like, well, the author of The Hunger definitely didn't, it was kind of like, you know, listen, you did say it first, okay? We started talking about it before this, so I am not, in fact, bringing up the terror, all right? You've already opened that door.
You brought it up, and now you're using the fact that you previously brought it up as a fact to justify that you're bringing it up now.
Cornelius Hickey, all right? our sweet boy, our cannibal god king, who makes a lot of bad choices in the book. Dan Brown? No, not Dan Brown. Did Dan Brown write this? Who the fuck is the
Dan
author?
Brown did not write it, because at no point does a pope, like, fucking skateboard kickflip across the terror and then just disappear.
There's, like, weird religious subtext. Who wrote the terror? Wow, this is bad.
Dan Simmons.
That's it.
You are always actively nutting over the terror, and you can't even be bothered to remember the author of the book it's based on.
Listen,
you
the book is
are
like
a coward and a liar
at this point. The book is all the only reason that I bring up the book is to talk about
you only care about Jared Harris's pretty face. You only care about Tobias Menzies and the fact that his last name sounds like Menzies, which is
don't be mean, you can't help that. Anyways, so, you know, Cornelius Hickey, mysterious author Dan What's-His-Face, said that he pretty much his characterization of Hickey was just based off the fact that one of the artifacts they found from the Franklin expedition was a knife with his name carved on it. Kesseberg's characterization in The Hunger was definitely a lot more historically accurate than that. This wasn't one of those things where it's like, well, he had a knife, so he probably declared himself an immortal being and ate all of his cohorts.
This was a lot more.
He was a fucking dick.
Yeah, when we talk about some of the specifics of cannibalism, I would love to talk to you about Louis Kesseberg, because he was a cannibal the way that nobody else in the group was.
Oh yeah, for sure. So,
also, just a dick from start to finish. This book is just like, they knew, people were in the party, like, they were pretty sure he was beating his wife. He made it, basically, that old man who's, like, they're, like, doing interviews at the party afterwards, and they're like, no one remembered his first name. And I was like, oh, that's so sad, old man who had to, you know. He basically directly chose to let him die. But other people could have picked him up, but, you know.
Yeah. It was kind of his fault in the beginning.
Kesseberg was a man who seemed to take advantage. A man who was ready to be bad.
Yeah.
In a situation when it went to shit, you know?
Yeah.
He was, like, prepped.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a series of issues that have plagued the Donner Party from the very start, some of which are sort of their fault and others which are not. They left a lot later than they were supposed to. I'm pretty sure that Hastings recommended that people not leave a certain point any later than May, and they left in what, like June or July?
They left, I think, about a month later than everyone else.
So they were running.
To be fair,
really,
though,
late.
Hastings probably got that date by just, like, throwing a dart.
Yeah, at a calendar. And they missed Hastings bringing the rest of the group through his cutoff by about a week. And he actually did get that group to California. They did not get snowed in. But the Donner Party, Hastings left them a note saying, like, hey, this route actually sucks, sorry, why don't you try going around it the other way? And so the Donner Party did that, but it actually added even more time onto them because they had to, again, cut their own route through these mountains and then make it across this salt desert. So they lost a lot of livestock, they lost a lot of time, and by the time that they got to the Sierra Nevadas, an early and really heavy snowfall was kind of the nail in the coffin. And so there
I wouldn't even say the nail of the coffin. It was like, the coffin is built. Who wants to lie in it now as we nail it shut for the next 4 months?
Yeah. So pretty much where things are at that point is that they are stuck at a place called Truckee Lake, which in the Wikipedia article is always like Truckee Lake, parentheses, now known as Donner Lake. Is there anything more sinister than the knowledge that the place where you currently are is going to bear your name for all of the future? Like, that's just, I wouldn't want to know that, okay? Like, if you're just like some guy who happens to be at some place and you're like, yeah, like this gulch, it's going to be named Fisher Gulch after this. I'll be like, oh God, what happens to me? Like, how do I get fucked up so bad that this place
you
gets
are
named?
Such a pessimist, because I feel like almost every other single person in the world would be like, guess I discovered it, you know, guess I did a cool thing. You are in Washington State. I am outside Washington DC. George Washington, you think someone ever went up to him and was just like, someday places will be named after you, and he was like, oh no, what did I do? Oh God, I must have fucked up in a lot of different locations.
Okay, firstly, he did, and secondly, maybe he should have been asking himself, oh God, what did I do? I mean, I don't actually know the specifics of George Washington's crimes. I'm just assuming that there are many.
he owned people, so.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, fine, I'll concede to that, but I still find it kind of, like, grimly funny, like, Truckee Lake,
there's a picnic.
Now known as Donner Lake, like, yeah.
There's a picnic area there now called Donner Picnic Area.
Oh no, are you fucking kidding me?
Insensitive, huh?
Oh, that's not great. Also, I wish I gotta go there now. I gotta, can we put this episode on pause? I gotta drive real quick.
Do you have a birthday gift to give to yourself?
I mean, I did literally consider driving to the Donner Pass for my birthday, but I was like, that's so far.
Crazy.
That's like literally a 20-hour drive for
It was a 20-hour drive. Oh, no. Oh, no. They only walked for 7 years in the desert.
Hey, they walked for, like, 1 year. Fucking whatever. And a lot of that was, like, not walking. Although, it's interesting. Apparently, a lot of times on the wagon trains, people would mostly walk in order to help lighten the load so that the oxen wouldn't tire.
For precious, precious oxen. Does that sound sarcastic? It's not. I'm just thinking.
It sounded really sarcastic. I was going to be like, Sarah, they depend on them for their lives.
I would be so stressed about these oxen. I would be like, if you get to the other fucking side, I'm never going to make you do any work. You're going to live. You can become fat. You're just going to become fat old oxen. You're going to fuck all the lady oxen that I can get you. You're going to be so good. You just got to keep going, bud. I love you so much. Please don't make me push this fucking wagon.
Well, you wouldn't be pushing it. You'd be abandoning it, which a lot of people did actually have to do, especially in the trek across the salt desert. Apparently, it was just like a trail of people's possessions that they were leaving behind as they constantly tried to lighten the load because the oxen had no water, they had no food, they were weakening, and they just couldn't keep pulling. But anyways, so now...
Do you want to talk about how the Terror had a bunch of useless shit on their ship that they tried to carry with them and no one... They should have left a lot more of it behind?
There's actually this great quote from episode 7 of the Terror when they're preparing to walk out when... You know what? No, I'm not gonna...
Finish it!
No, it's okay. Let's keep going.
It's your birthday and you deserve to quote the Terror.
Yeah, you know, that would have been a good birthday gift for me, is we just do another episode of the Terror.
Anyway, do you want to talk more about the horrific deaths of these hardworking people?
Yes, that sounds good. Well, not good, but...
Yeah. Let's get into a couple specific moments of horror. Namely, I want to talk about the group, the Forlorn Hope.
Yeah, which is such a 1860s pioneer name.
Yeah, 1840s.
No, it's 1860s.
No, it's 1840. It's 1846.
Yeah, that's it, sorry.
You said the date. You were the one who said it.
You're right, I'm a dummy who mixed up numbers.
It's cool. 6, 9.
No, because I was talking about the Civil War. That's why it was. Okay.
You were. Yeah. I know.
See,
and you were
smart.
Like,
I know stuff.
Do you say I'm no stuff?
No. Maybe. I don't actually know. Can we talk about.
The Forlorn Hope was also what they called people in World War I who were the first to go over the. I can't even remember what it's called anymore. I need to restudy World War I.
Oh my god, Sarah forgot a fact about World War I. Holy shit, next thing you know, I'm not going to be able to quote every episode of The Terror from memory.
We should watch War Horse for this.
Oh my god. You mean the movie where you literally, like, sobbed the entire time?
There was, like, 15 minutes at the beginning I didn't. When it was just, like, about a boy and his horse and who gave a fuck.
Over the...
The Forlorn Hope was also... The Forlorn Hope is never a group.
Over the...
Yeah, over the top. That's what
there
it is.
You
when
go.
You're the first
See,
group
you
to go
it.
Over
you
the top.
It. You got it.
Thank you. It's never a great group to be in, but it is a very essential group that needs to happen, you know?
Yeah.
And so these were 17 people, including Sarah Graves, who... And her husband and her father, who snowshoed to... try and get a rescue. And there's like this one part where it's like, if they'd gone left, they would have been there. But they didn't they had no way of knowing that. So they went right instead. And it's just like, oh God. Like, I can't even imagine navigating the mountains that I've never been in the snow while freezing and starving to death.
Yeah.
Like,
and I mean, so much of the Donner's story. And I mean, we say the Donners, but there's like a lot more family groups within that. And in fact, I don't think any members of the Donner family were a part of the Forlorn Hope, but so I don't know why I said that really. but in general, all the people in this, you can look back and be like, if they had just gone a week faster, they might have caught up with Hastings and been a part of the whole group and they would have made it through. Or if they had just left on the day that they arrived at the mountains, maybe they could have made it past the snow. But it's all these things that in hindsight, you know, they never could have known.
Yeah, it's like a lot of things that where you're just like, if only I'd gone just like a little bit faster, done a little bit harder, but you don't know at the time. You do the best you can, and then you live with the consequences, or not, as the case is. So the Forlorn Hope has what I believe is the first incidence of cannibalism in the party, where they are basically, they took food with them, but it runs out. Pretty early on into their desperate trek. Obviously, they have access to water in the form of surrounded by snow on all sides. But, you know, that's less than ideal for reasons I feel like people can provide for themselves.
Yeah.
And there's that part where I think it was Patrick Dolan who was like, we need to draw straws to see who we're going to kill and eat. And then they're like, no, this is barbaric. And then they're like, actually, yes, let's do it. So which is actually a cool, quote-unquote, like, naval tradition. Tradition being a strong word for it. But there's precedent for it. And it pretty much never seems to go great anytime you read a story about it.
Well, things in those circumstances are already not going great, so I guess it kind of makes sense.
You are already eating some people, so...
Yeah, and then the nightmare was about to begin. Like, I think things are pretty fucked up if you're already considering killing and eating somebody, so... Yeah, so pretty much, like, a few people die, the group ends up kind of camped out.
Oh! One of them is the great Mr. Graves. Franklin Graves, Sarah and Mary's father. And as he's dying, he, like, looks up at them and he's like, you need to eat my body, because if you two die, no one is going to save the rest of the family. I love you, goodbye. Which is just, like, this... I can imagine saying it. I can't imagine following through on it, you know?
Yeah, God.
But also the pressure that was up on those two women of just, like, you must commit cannibalism because there is so much more than just you on the line.
Yeah, and I mean, that whole moment in the book was just really powerful. And that's one thing about The Hunger is that I was reading this book and I was like, I literally cannot believe that this wasn't included in The Hunger. Like, I still have no idea why it wasn't included. Like, that for me is what it's all about. That moment where someone's father has to tell his children that they have to eat his body in order to survive. Like,
They don't actually eat his body.
And that's an interesting thing, you know, where because there were a few bodies at the time when it was finally decided, like, okay, we gotta eat these, they essentially divided them up in such a way that nobody would end up eating anybody who was, like, related to them, essentially.
Yeah.
Because somehow, you know, on top of the cannibalism, eating a family member was even more taboo than just eating human flesh in general, which I thought was interesting, you know? Because and there was this other interesting fact they mentioned about how and apparently this is common in many instances of cannibalism, that people will remove the head, hands, and feet of the body to make it seem less human. Makes sense.
It's really interesting, the point that they have to be at as a group to do cannibalism. Because they do, I mean, there's a bunch of discrete acts of cannibalism. The Forlorn Hope decides on cannibalism separate from the party at the lake, you know? Like, they weren't in communication. So they kind of separately both reach the point where cannibalism is necessary to survive. The evidence that we have is that apart from our boy, Kesseberg, most people would have only, as far as we know, there's a good suggestion that basically, the practice of consuming the bodies for everyone except him would have been something that was, like, you did for a week or two at most. Like, that it was truly this last-ditch desperation that came before death or rescue, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, like, you know, the amount of the things that they're, like, boiling different, anything that had leather, boiling to eat that, eating, like, glue from books. I don't think that's Donna Party, actually. I believe that would be Leningrad, another case of starvation and people scrounging for food.
Yeah, but they, like, did talk about how they would basically, they when they killed the oxen initially, when they got snowed in, they used the hides at first to help put roofs over these abandoned cabins that they were staying in and use them as, like, blankets and rugs, and then eventually it came down to them literally boiling the hides to, like, scrape the gross, gluey inside away from the hair itself so that they could eat that. God, just the details of what they actually ate. You know, the fact that they would just boil bones to make broth, like, over and over until they literally disintegrated. The author literally talks about people catching mice and just eating them alive because they were just so hungry.
Oof. Honestly, the mice sounds like pretty ideal compared to some of the other stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, but like,
just
the,
like a
the alive
son
part
of warm blood
is less,
yeah,
less ideal.
Less ideal. Yeah, well, there was in 2010, there was a study that got kind of taken out of context that suggested that there wasn't actually any cannibalism in the Donner Party, which more accurately to say there wasn't in the beginning of this assessment of the remains found at the lake camp. There wasn't immediate signs of cannibalism the same way that there are signs of eating animals. And that's how, I mean, there was cannibalism. We have written testimony.
Yeah.
We know, like,
yeah, don't
we have
try and take
a lot
this
of evidence. But it's the kind of thing where it's like, it's because the human remains were not nearly as destroyed as the animal remains in this hopes for any fucking nutrient, which is why we think that for most people it was a last-ditch attempt, that they didn't have to stretch as much as they did the animals, because we don't have the evidence of them, like, boiling the bones repeatedly to crack them open and get the marrow, you know?
Although I'm pretty sure they did find, like, a skull that looked like it had been cracked open, which that was probably our
That's
boy
Lewis,
Kessifer.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he was the one who was, yeah, he's the exception. He's lived for at least a couple months on pure cannibalism.
That's the dream, buddy.
No.
No, it's really not. He was a fucking terrible person. But
do you want to talk about what happens when you starve?
Yeah, please tell me some interesting starvation facts.
Do you want me to say it not in that tone?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to talk generally about, like, what would be happening to them, because even when they had food, it wasn't always the right food, you know, so you can basically, in starvation or lack of good food intake, you can have lack of calories, lack of nutrients, or both. Lack of nutrients and lack of calories is the shittiest, but lack of nutrients can mean that even if you're getting adequate calories, like, you know, sometimes in the case of cannibalism, if you're not eating, but if you're not eating the parts that you need, like good protein to help rebuild what your body has broken down, you're still going to be suffering from a lot of the effects of malnutrition.
Like
having
scurvy.
Said that, yes, like in the terror, Amelia.
Yeah.
having said that, we think they probably weren't actually to the point of dying from starvation when they did cannibalism, but that's sort of because, like, starvation is not really the thing that kills you. Starvation makes your body so weak that an infection kills you, or that the elements kill you.
Yeah.
So more likely, people weren't dying of starvation, they were dying of hypothermia, because their body could no longer warm itself, because it had no more energy. Which is sort of a nitpicking distinction, but is the kind of thing, well, if they died of hypothermia and not starvation, if they'd built a fire, you know, if they'd kept themselves warm better, they wouldn't have needed to resort to cannibalism.
Yeah, but then it becomes this thing, and I know that you were probably going to say this, but it, like, becomes this thing where it's like, well, how do you build a fire if you're too weak to go get wood, you know?
Exactly.
In the fucking snow, like.
So, what I thought was interesting is that there's three distinct stages of starvation, which is when your body, one is early on, and it's not really starvation, it's just that you're no longer actively eating. It's when your body is using the glucose and the glucogen to get the energy it needs. Then if you go longer, it starts breaking down fat. Fat is our long-term storage of energy. Fat is so useful. Fat is an insulator. Fat is cushioning. Fat is energy.
More cushion for the pushing.
More cushion for the pushing, because if you don't have fat over your bony prominences, you're more likely to get bed sores. Fat is so incredibly useful. So when you've stopped breaking down fat, then you go on to breaking down protein, and this is sort of the last part of starvation. This is when you really get the cachectic skeletal look. And the super skinny arms, the gaunt face. You've already depleted all of your fat reserves, but now you're, like, moving on to your muscle. It can be both your muscle, protein from your muscle, and protein from your cells. Neither one is something you can really afford to lose, because protein's actually a pretty inefficient way to get to thing to break down to get your energy in comparison to fat. It's something like fat has like 9 calories, protein has like 5, you know, per unit.
Yeah, Sarah, so maybe you should stop spurning the delicious fatty part of the steak when we go out.
Listen, we're gonna, if someone was like, hey, you're going on a westward expedition, do you want this fatty bit of steak? I would be like, hell yeah, I want to gain 30 pounds.
No, you wouldn't.
We go.
You'd be like, okay.
Yes, but I would still eat it, because I have come to the conclusion that the best thing I could do for, if I was Sarah Graves, and I had any inkling of what was ahead, I would not work out, because they were buff as hell from the hard work of their life, and you know, the book mentions this. They had a lot of muscles, and that worked against them, because muscles just in your body burn more fat, burn more calories than fat.
Just when you're sitting around doing nothing, if you have more muscles, then having more muscles means you burn more calories.
Yeah. Like, it's called your basal metabolic rate. It's the basic amount of calories you need for your body to function. If you the more muscle you have, the higher your basal metabolic rate, which is great if you're working out and you want to be like, even when I'm sitting around, I want to be burning mad calories, bro. But that's less than ideal in a circumstance in which you're not getting enough food to start.
Yeah.
Secondly, the more fat you have, the longer you can break down fat. So just squeeze your ass and be like, not juicy enough, and then eat some more cake, because you need to pack on as much fat as you can.
God, yeah, be the fattest bear competition of your dreams.
Oh, I just want to, like, I want to start as jiggly as possible, with, like, no muscle strength.
Just be like an adult baby, but not the kink thing, like a literal, the actual fat proportions of a baby as an adult.
Exactly.
And one interesting thing the author brought up was the fact that more women survived the expedition than men by a fairly large margin. And yeah, they did say that one potential reason for that was the fact that A, the men were expending more energy because they were the ones who were expected to do the manual labor, and B, they were also, as a result of that manual labor before that, were the ones who had a lot more muscle mass and less fat, and also the fact that women just naturally have more fat.
Yeah.
So suck
it,
men.
Boobs are just fat.
I know.
Yeah, suck it, babies, on my fatty titties. Anyway.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we are running short on time, so we're probably not going to have time to cover all the details of the rescue party, which it really took a lot of effort and multiple attempts to get all of the people who survived out of there, but
yeah, I'd say a solid third of the book happens after they've technically been rescued.
Yeah. But I, for one, highly recommend reading this if you're interested in the Donner Party or survival situations or cannibalism. It's just super interesting. A lot of great extra details about other events or histories that will tie into things really well. And I thought that it had a really good sort of narrative plot line that made it like an actually interesting story as well as an informative take on the real history.
Yeah, I thought it was a compassionately written book about a horrible time, and I'm really glad that I don't live then.
God, yeah. Holy
God.
Shit.
And no, I mean, I couldn't do a good westward journey. Let's make that clear. My sole plan I've offered is carbo loading.
Yeah.
So, like,
I mean, it's not
the only the only thing. I mean, listen, my plan is to be beautiful and thick.
It's a good start. I think we've covered some pretty good survival tips this episode. You gotta be thick. That's a good start. You gotta leave on time, all right? You can't be late. You gotta not take the shortcut.
If you're going to do cannibalism, don't be a dick about it.
Don't be a dick about it. Be cool, man. Be cool.
Like, even if all, hypothetically, your whole life you've been fucking quivering with the desire to eat human flesh, Amelia, just keep it on, like, the down low when the time comes, because you're gonna be, like, looking someone in the eye and be like, your uncle was delicious, thank you for his sacrifice.
Yeah, God. See, if we keep talking about this, I'm gonna be tempted to, like, talk about more of the stuff from the book.
Oh, thank God. I was like, if we can't...
No, not from real life. Please, let's not.
No, I wasn't talking about cannibalizing your uncle. I just thought the sentence was like, oh, if we talk any more about this, I'm gonna go out and kill someone and eat them.
I mean...
It's my fault. That was my bad.
So, do we have any other hot takes before we wrap this up?
Hot take is I'm really sad for Sarah Graves.
Yeah, God.
But I'm really proud of her, too.
Yeah.
But if there's a heaven, hope that girl is chilling there.
Tut, chilling. Get it? 'Cause cold.
If there's a heaven, I hope she is, leaning over, tugging on God's shoulder hair.
Shoulder hair?
His shoulder length hair, and just saying, don't let Amelia in.
Okay, that's a good clarification, but I kind of am now stuck on the mental image of God sitting there shirtless and just being really fucking hairy. God is a bear.
God has mad back hair. God is thick with four C's. That's why he's God. Can God, like, make something so thick that not even he can conceive of it?
What are we fucking talking about?
I think my ultimate conclusion is the same one that this author makes at the end of the book when it slips in the first-person narrative and he describes going to these places, and he talks about how hot it was to walk and then going and sitting down in his air-conditioned car and just feeling the relief, and he just thinks, I think the exact quote is, my God, these people were so tough.
Yeah. I mean, it really is, I don't know, kind of amazing and bracing, you know, where, like, obviously the history of westward expansion is, like, so fucked up when you really think about it. But then on an individual micro level, there was a lot of personal bravery that went into it. And I think that both of those things are a part of the history. You know, the fact that you don't have to negate, you know, how meaningful it was for people on a personal level and the challenges they faced with the fact that of, like, the macro scale of negative repercussions this led to.
Boy, we're just, like, really horned up for this book.
God, I really am. It was a very good book. And actually, I'm super horned up for what we're going to be doing for our next episode. Are we ready to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. This is, like, your fucking thing.
Yeah.
This is, like, you. When I think of you, I'm like this.
Yes. So, for our next episode, which is actually going to be a special episode that we're just going to post a few days after this one on Halloween, we are doing one of my all-time favorite horror novels, The Haunting of Hill House. Although, technically, Sarah is doing The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson, and I am doing The Haunting of Hill House, the television show that they just made about it. So, we're going to do kind of a comparison of those two things, and I mean, we were technically just gonna do the book, but then I remembered that I lent it to my friend like 3 years ago and never got it back, and obviously because of the TV show, there's like 60 holds placed on every copy, so yeah, I'm just gonna watch the Netflix.
I was about to make fun of you for forgetting that libraries existed, but it seems like you remembered it, and then so did everyone else.
Yeah, so I really missed that copy, though. I really loved the cover. Hey, well, you know,
maybe for your birthday, I'll send you a copy. Yeah. No, I already got you gifts.
I want a different gift. I want this gift.
You don't even know what I got you yet.
It wasn't good enough, probably.
It's a photo of Jared Harris looking uncomfortable.
Why is he uncomfortable?
Because he didn't know I was taking his photo until I popped up from underneath his dining room table.
But just Happy uncomfortable, birthday. Not afraid, or, like, calling the police, I guess?
No, this is, like, the third time I've done it to him. I just pop up being like, me, personally, never seen the terror. But I'm sure you did a great job. Anyway, this has been Cracked Spines. We'll be talking to you real soon about a much less horrifying story, because it's not real.
I mean, it's still kind of horrifying, actually. It contains some of the most terrifying sentences in English literature, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah? Well, you fucking read them to us, then. You can't. You lost your fucking book. Get out of here.
You're rubbing in my face. How am I supposed to read the first paragraph every night before I go to sleep?
You just Google it. It's a famous paragraph.
I just memorize it. It's fine. I am trying to literally think if I could... how much of it I could recite from memory. Probably none. I would fuck it up within 3 words, but...
Well, that'll be a fun... We will play that game next time. Sweet. On our podcast. Cracked Spines. We don't have an outro. Don't eat your loved ones.